5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
You make $5 million a year. I'm a jerk on the radio. I know better.
Those are facts. Print that. Tweet that.
I don't like people or teams or products that dodge the heavy lifting.
If you don't like what we say or anybody says, here's what I would suggest. Get a rating.
The idea that you preface your opinion by what your identity is to me insane.
You gotta be kidding me. You can't run this clown out of town fast enough.
This man is a disgrace. He's throwing everything away. Get him the hell out.
That is a take. It's a strong take. It's one of the best takes ever.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. Now, here's your host, Jason Barrett.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. I am Jason Barrett. Thanks for making the time to listen. This series puts a focus on the career travels and experiences of sports media professionals. On this particular episode, the 8th installment of Season 4, my guest is 101 ESPN's Michelle Smallman. My chat with her is just a few minutes away. I do want to thank Core Image Studio for their support of the podcast. Justin Dove delivers top-notch imaging services for sports media brands, so if you're looking to elevate the performance of your station, take the time to check them out at coreimagestudio.com. You'll thank me later for the tip. There are a few items I want to make sure you guys are aware of before we dive into today's conversation. First, we've launched a few different podcasts under the Barrett Sports Media umbrella. Be sure to check out the Producers Podcast with Dimitri Ravanos and the Under the Radar Podcast with Brandon Contis. You can find both on our website, BarrettSportsMedia.com, under the BSM Podcast tab or by scrolling down the page. Secondly, our big annual sports media conference, the BSM Summit, is coming to New York City on February 26th and 27th. 24 speakers have been announced so far, and we'll have many more when all is said and done. For tickets, hotel rooms, or to submit a speaker request, visit bsmsummit.com. And last but not least, for those of you who follow me on Twitter at SportsRadioPD, you've probably noticed we've been running more poll questions lately. Learning what you guys do and don't value is very helpful. If I can trouble you to continue participating or even share some of our content, it'd be greatly appreciated. We've started giving away a weekly prize for those who support our work, so hopefully you guys will win in the near future. But now it's time to shift our attention to today's guest, and that is someone I've had the pleasure of working with in the past and continue to stay in touch with today, Michelle Smallman. Michelle broke into the sports radio business at my old stomping grounds in St. Louis, 101 ESPN. She did a great job producing there and in the process earned national attention from the folks at the ESPN radio network, who eventually hired her to work with George Sedano, Ryan Russillo, Danny Cannell, and a few others. Following a few years in Bristol, she returned home to St. Louis to embark on a career on the air with 101 ESPN, and she now does on-air work for the station, along with guiding their social media strategy. Michelle has a lot of passion and energy for this industry. She's supremely talented and bright, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing her perspectives. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Michelle Smallman.
3, 2...
All right, so growing up in St. Louis, obviously a big sports fan, when did you first become even interested in sports radio, sports television?
That's an interesting question because it just kind of happened to me. I feel like most tent poles in my career just kind of happened. You make plans and then other opportunities present themselves. So growing up in St. Louis, most people here are diehard sports fans. I'm super close with my dad and he used to take me to all the games. But I went to college. I wanted to be a dermatologist. I know. It's crazy.
I didn't even know this.
Yeah. So I've told this story before to other people, but never to you. So I went to the University of Illinois. I go to my very first class on campus. It's like a 300-person lecture hall. hall chemistry class. The professor walks in, starts writing chemical equations on the board. And I was like, I got to get out of here. This is never going to work for me. I am not a math person. And my freshman year of college just so happened to be the year that Illinois went to the national championship game in college basketball. And that team is still my favorite team of all time.
Okay.
That 2005 Illini team, they got robbed by UNC in the national championship game. But the entire campus was electric with that team. Everybody was obsessed with them. I went to all the games. I was in the Orange Crush. I would get the Daily Illini every day to read about the team. And so I went to my advisor and I said, I want to work in sports. I want to be part of what makes everyone come together in this. And I wanted to be a sports writer. And she said, you're a female. You have a deep voice. You need to go into broadcasting. And I said, okay. So I'm very type A. And I felt like I was a year behind because I, you know, was on the pre-med track before. So I said, any internship that comes across your desk, you let me know. So she started funneling things my way. And then I was dabbling here and there, doing like Monday Night Football locally here. And I took one radio class in college and I hated it. I never even thought radio would be on the chart for me. And so when I came home, I got a job locally in TV at KSDK. And then ESPN Radio came to town. And right. You probably remember this. I was doing the weekend show.
314 Sports.
Yes, that's right. With Rennie Knott. And
I had to tell Rennie, listen, I like that you bring other people in, but I'd really like to hear you on the show too.
Yes.
Rennie liked to go to you a lot.
Yeah, he did. That's right. Because we would have myself as the Illinois person and Larry Thornton right. as the Mizzou guy.
Right.
Exactly. And so I'll never forget, you and I got in touch and you said, hey, there's this job that I think you should apply for.
Right.
And I was like, what is it? And you said, it's a producer job for Bernie Miklas. And I thought, well, I've never produced radio in my life. I don't really want to work in radio. Bernie's a legend. I'll never get this job. And then somehow I landed it.
Well, let's go to that. So what do you remember from that interview process?
I remember the very last interview. I remember at first coming in, meeting you and thinking, okay, I'm never going to make it to the next round. And then I made it to the next round and then the next round. And the final round was with Bernie, just solo. And I'll never forget this conversation. I've told it before, especially to other women trying to break into the industry, because I always tell them to have confidence in themselves, because this was very out of character for me as a young girl breaking into this industry. But Bernie is very blunt and he said, hey, listen, there's two people that are down to the wire for this job, you and this other guy. And this other guy has a ton of experience, and I know that he can do the job. But frankly, I don't know if I'm going to want to come in and work with him every day. He's like, but you have zero experience. I have no idea if you're going to be good at this job, but I can tell you're hungry and I like you. So I don't really know what to do. And I just said to him, hey, listen, if this guy's as good as you say he is, then he's going to have no problem finding a new gig when you hire me. And Bernie laughed, and then I left, and I called my dad, and I went, oh, my God, you will not believe what I said to Bernie. I will never get this job. And then I got it.
Listen, that's like you've seen the movie The Pursuit of Happiness?
Yes.
When he shows up with all the bosses and they go, you know, what would you say if I hired this guy with that kind of shirt? Will Smith says he must have had on one hell of a pair of pants. And I'm like, hey, listen, sometimes like when I got and Luis Cornetto, who I know you know, will appreciate this. I remember when I was interviewing for ESPN Radio. And I still have the email to this day. So if she ever tells me it was not true, I will prove that it was true. She had sent to me an email and said, listen, I like you a lot. I think you could work here. However, we're a little concerned about your lack of big market experience. And I said, well, listen, I can't control that my father raised me an hour and a half outside New York City and that I had to work my way up through the small markets. And here's the bottom line. I can't control that I didn't live in New York, LA, or Boston. But the New York Giants once hired Bill Parcells from West Point. They won two Super Bowls. You need to decide if you want to win two Super Bowls with Bill Parcells or if you'd rather have somebody from a bigger market. And I remember after I sent that, I'm like, oh, my God, that might have been a really dumb idea. Somehow I got called. You know, listen, you got one shot. Swing for the fence. Say what you think. You got to show some confidence or you're not going to get the gig. And when you're sitting there with the most, you know, let's call it what it is, Bernie Miklas is one of the most influential people to ever work in St. Louis sports media. Mm-hmm. You can't leave that room and not have him feeling like, yes, I need this person on my show.
Right.
And you obviously struck a chord with him by having a really creative line, even though you might have been second guessing whether or not it was a good idea.
Yeah, and I, you know, growing up in the Midwest as a girl, I was kind of shy, not really shy, but I just have never really said anything like that, that bold or that emphatic. And it was so out of character for me, but I just kind of felt in the moment like, if I'm not going to tell him he should hire me, why should he think to hire me?
Right.
And I think now in retrospect, looking back, especially in a producer role, a talent wants a producer that's going to tell them what's up and that's going to be bold and going to be confident and going to say, hey, you need to say this in the tease, or hey, you need to talk about this or change topics, or I called five people and they're going to come on the show tomorrow. So without me even knowing it, I was showing him that I was capable of doing that job.
Well, talk to me about producing him, because Bernie is one of the most, for those who are listening to this who've never been around him, I mean, he is one of the most prepared people. You can almost feel intimidated in the prep process that you're not on his level, because he's on such a high level with how much he knows and how many sources he has. What was it like producing him? How did you get through to him when you know that he knows basically everything there is to talk about, yet you have to bring ideas to the table that are going to, you know, certainly fascinate him to want to talk about on the show?
I think my lack of experience actually helped me in that position, because I could ask a ton of questions. I could be like, hey, I've never done this before, so you tell me, what do you want? Or I've observed this. Do you want me to supplement you in this way with this topic? So to your point, I learned very quickly. I mean, to say he's prepared is the understatement of the century. He knows everything. He has stats. He has topic ideas. He has spoken to every person that he needs to speak to understand what's going on in a situation. He's written the authority piece on it already.
Right.
So I learned he's going to have his topics prepared. He's going to have the stats. He's going to have all of this. I'm going to make sure that I have dynamite guests on the show. I'm going to make sure that I send him fun, off-the-beaten-path stories that he may not know. I'm going to make sure that if I read a feature on a player that maybe the is on a team that the Cardinals are playing, that I say, hey, did you see this about Anthony Rizzo and what he's doing with his charity? It's kind of interesting. Maybe you can use it in the bits. Just little things like that to help him in ways that he wouldn't necessarily be doing. And the guest thing, and you were my, obviously, program director at the time, the guest thing I think was huge, because when you have a person like Bernie who is such an authority, you need to make sure that every person that's coming on the show is bringing that in some way, whether it's a big name or a player or a GM or someone who has really done a major deep dive into a topic. So that's probably where I spent the majority of my time, was just picking up the phone and calling people.
Well, it's a brand image. If you tell people this is the most important authority figure in St. Louis sports, you expect to hear people of that magnitude on that show.
Right.
And so, you know, it's no knock on some other lesser named guest who might bring good content, but you want the big name guest that brings the same level of content, because that's the expectation when you work with someone like that. I mean, from that standpoint, when you produced him, what was the best part of producing him? What was the hardest part of producing him?
I think the best part, as far as the actual day-to-day producing, is when you know you need to deliver on big guests. Oftentimes, because I've produced a lot of different shows, even getting your foot in that door is hard. So the fact that I'm picking up the phone to call somebody and I'm saying I'm calling on behalf of Bernie Miklas is already a win.
Right.
Because they know who he is. Oftentimes they have a relationship with him. And it was rarely a no, and if it was a no, it's a let's try and find another time to do it, which I learned quickly was not the norm, right? When you're producing, normally people are not like, let me try and find a time to accommodate this person. Normally it's like, hey, 15 other shows have called me. Can you back off?
Right.
But with Bernie, he had a relationship with so many people, so I certainly worked that to my advantage. That doesn't mean booking guests is easy, but I think that sitting in that chair working with him, that was certainly an advantage. And I think the most difficult part is when you come in to produce, oftentimes you think that you're in control of everything. But working with someone who has this wealth of knowledge and knows a topic inside and out, he's going to throw things on the air that you don't even know that he has. You know, so it's hard to supplement or help him in that way when you don't necessarily even know what he's going to bring to the table, because he just has it inside of him.
And sometimes, you know, as the talent, you can't communicate it. It just comes to you in that moment, and you don't have time to go, let's prepare for this.
Totally.
So it's an off-the-cuff thing. What's interesting is you learned, obviously, working around him, you know, the expectation to do a great radio show that springboards you to going to Bristol, Connecticut, where you talk about guest quality. They expect that every day on the network. And you started off originally, if I remember right, with George Sedano, right?
Yep.
At night. Was that when Stink was there too, or was that right after Schlereth and him weren't together?
They weren't together. My first show was George and Jen with Sedano and Jen Latta. So my very first day in Bristol, you have a rookie camp, and you know, you go and you do your HR thing. So your rookie camp's usually 2 days. Mine was Monday, Tuesday. Wednesday, my first day, I believe it was Wednesday, if I remember correctly, they had a big department meeting, the entire radio staff, and they announced that Colin Cowherd's leaving. And so that sent a major domino effect.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one.
In the department, because he's a huge piece of the lineup. And, you know, then his producers are moving to different shows and they're shaking things up. So I originally went there to work College Game Day. And then I worked nights. And then I worked George and Jen. And then I got moved to this piece. And then Sedano had a solo show. And then, you know, I got moved to Russillo and Cannell. And then it was the Russillo show. I've worked on a lot of iterations of different shows.
So when you first went through the process, because I know how I felt when ESPN called me. And I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe that I'm talking to ESPN about a job, and then it comes up and you're like, oh my God, I've made it, and it's an awesome feeling. Mm-hmm. Then you get there and it's, although this is awesome, now I'm supposed to be on this level. They thought I was good enough to be here. I got to perform and show that I belong here. When you started working with George, you know, and you're trying to prove that, one, you're trying to settle into a new area where you haven't lived. Mm-hmm. It's the best of the best. Mm-hmm. You're working with a show that's obviously going through change during this process, given the lineup stuff you mentioned. I mean, how did you build your connection with George?
So George has ended up being, you know, one of the biggest mentors in my career and in my life. And, you know, he's from Miami, so he knows what it's like to move from somewhere different and go to Bristol, Connecticut. And I, again, kind of use the same approach that I did with Bernie, where I'm like, I don't really know what you need and what you want. And I'll never forget the first time we met off campus. We went to a Mexican restaurant in Bristol and we just sat there. We had some margaritas and he was like, all right, here's me. Here's what I need. And I was like, all right, well, here's me. Here's what I can give you. And from that first day, we had a very open line of communication. And he would tell, so I come from a market that didn't have NBA. And George is obviously from Miami, the LeBron thing. He's very solid in the NBA. So he never held that against me. Instead, he would use that as a way to help guide me and help me build my NBA Rolodex. He would shoot me numbers, or he would say, hey, these are the topics that we need to focus on. So he really helped grow me in that area. And then from there, I was able to springboard into different sectors too. Mm-hmm. But he really, really helped me out.
So when you went through the interview process with ESPN to land that job, did you give them one of those speeches that you gave to Bernie?
No, I did not. That process, as I'm sure you remember, I didn't even know what I was doing. You fly out there. I landed at like midnight in the middle of the night. I had to drive from Hartford to Bristol. I'm staying at this hotel. And then you get in there at—
Were you at the Residence Inn down the street?
Yes, I was. I wish I was at the Doubletree. It's closer. But no, I'll never forget. You get there and you go through the gate and you get your guest pass. And you know it's big, but the first time you go there and you see campus,
oh, it's amazing.
It's overwhelming.
Yep.
And they have you there from something like 7:30 a.m. until 6 p.m. I think I had 7 or 8 interviews that day with 7 or 8 different people. And they do a very good job of walking the line of, we're interviewing you, you need to be on your A game, but look at how special this place is, and don't you want to be here? It's almost like sorority rush.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving there being like, I don't know if I'm good enough to work here, but man, I want to be.
Yep.
And so I was pumped I got the job.
When you got the call, where were you and how'd you handle it?
So for me, it happened super quickly. It was kind of a weird thing, but Dave Roberts had called me through somebody that he knew at the network that had recommended me. They had an opening in radio, and he called me, asked me a few questions, and then said, hey, I want to have somebody reach out to you about a potential interview. So that same week, they called me. I think I flew out on a Friday, or I flew out on a Thursday, interviewed on a Friday. They offered me, if I'm remembering correctly, on a Monday, and this was in July, and said, hey, we need you here in 2 weeks because we need you ready to go by football season. So I had no time to waste.
Right.
And I had to figure out my personal life. Like, there was a lot of things going on there. I had to decide if I was going to leave here because I was working with the Fastlane and I loved my guys. And obviously, I love St. Louis and my family. And I just thought, is this something I really want to do? And then at the end of the day, it's your dream to work at ESPN. The ESPN calls you and says, you want to do this? And I said, yep. So I just packed up my life and moved out there in two weeks.
And the other thing you learn, and now that you're back in St. Louis, is you learn is like, listen, nobody said you had to stay there for 30 years. It doesn't mean you won't. I mean, there are a lot of people who've been there a long time, and who the hell wouldn't want to work at ESPN for a long time? But there are also different things that change in your life as you go, and what you felt the first day you walk in, 2 years later, you go, this is awesome. I know I'm good enough. I know I belong here. But one day I want to go back home because I miss my family. I miss my local teams, and I just want to be around local stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that, but now I've had the fill of both, and I'm probably better served going into the local market. I want to talk to you about, because you went from Sedano eventually to Rosillo.
Yep.
When you made that change, I remember this. You were initially hesitant to go on to Rosillo.
Yeah.
All right. Why?
Well, there's a couple factors there. First of all, it kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting it when they said, hey, we're going to move you to this show. And the first thing I thought was, oh, this is exactly the type of show I've wanted to work on because they travel. They get to go to the big games. It's in a major day part. It's on TV, all of these other things. But then I thought, okay, but I also don't know how to do any of this TV stuff. And I've never produced one of these big shows. And I know Ryan has a lot of the same. He's very similar to Bernie in the fact that no one is more prepared than Rosillo.
Right.
And he's going to come in every day and he's going to know the 4 to 7 best topics that he wants to talk about. And he's super prepared. And that's intimidating to a lot of people. And a lot of people had said to me, like, hey, he is really buttoned up. You better be ready to go if you're going to work with Rosillo. And I thought, well, I worked with Bernie. You know, I can do it. But still, there's that hesitancy there. Like, can I do this? But again, Ryan has ended up being a great co-worker, mentor for me. And I told him day one, I'm like, I don't know any of this TV stuff. So you're just going to have to bear with me as we get through this. And he was like, all right, cool. Well, I'll tell you what I need.
How inviting was he of you to join his show at that time?
He was awesome. So was Danny. I met with both of them individually before and was like, hey, this is me. You know, I'm so excited to join the show. And both of them were so welcoming. And that show staff that I worked on, we were all so tight. That's the thing I miss the most about the network is that direct show staff, whether it was myself, Cerruti, Ryan, Danny, Liam, Ray. I mean, we just all worked really, really well together and we had a lot of fun.
So what did you learn the most from working with them? And I'm going to ask you the same thing I asked you about Bernie. What was the most fun about working with them? What was the hardest part of producing them?
Of Rosillo and Canal? I think the best part about working with them, and there was a lot of positives, but we all were kind of in the same age bracket, if that makes sense, where it was like from Ryan to Danny to the bottom of the show, we all had the same sense of humor and we were all watching the same shows and we all liked the same music. And when we traveled, we'd like to do the same things. And I think oftentimes in media, particularly radio, because radio is such a transparent medium, chemistry is something you cannot fake.
Yep.
And we had that right away. And when you have that chemistry and you have that open line of communication, it makes it more fun to come into work. It makes work easier because you don't have to do this passive aggressive thing. And you know, when I try to explain what my job was to people, I'm like, you sit in this tiny room with these people all day. It's a very confined, intimate space. So you're either going to really love them or you're going to really hate them.
Yep.
And luckily for us, we all really liked each other. And you know, I think that when you do work in live media like that, it's very intense. You once that light goes on, you're in it. And you know, you don't really have time to think, you're reacting oftentimes. And when you trust the people you work with, it just makes it that much more seamless. So, and that's hard to duplicate, you know, that's really hard to find. So I certainly miss that. But I'm trying to think of what was challenging. I think the most challenging thing for me on that show was there were so many components happening at all times. So, you know, I'm executive producer on radio and I have this entire TV crew that's working with us simultaneously and it's in a different building across campus and we don't really know them and we're talking to them down the line and you know they had come to the pre-show meeting but we're hoping we're in sync with them. We're hoping that their crew is as in sync as we are. We're hoping that even though the rundown says we're going to talk NFL that there's breaking college football news that they know how to adapt quickly.
Right.
So there's a lot of things happening that are out of your hands and that was really hard as a producer for me to adjust to, especially early on.
So you spend time there, you work on the night show with Sedano, you go to Rosillo and Canal. Eventually, though, you choose to come back home, right? So you did what I did. I spent 2 years there, and I'm like, I can't believe I'm leaving ESPN. You make the same decision, I'm going to leave, and I got to go back home. What was it at that time that told you it's time to leave Bristol?
So it was a tough decision, obviously, because it's an incredible place to work. But I think for me, at the end of the day, it just kind of felt like the universe was telling me I needed to come home. And by that, I mean, you know, Rosilla was leaving. So our show, as it was currently constructed, was breaking up. The band was breaking up. And I love Will Kane, and we have a great relationship, and he's incredible to work with. And so I was pumped about that show. But then at the same time, I get this opportunity presented for me to come home. And I just thought, how strange that this show is ending and then I'm getting this opportunity at the exact same time.
Right.
And I consulted with a lot of people that I trust, like Rosillo, Sedano. I talked to Will Kane about it. And at the end of the day, when you have the opportunity to come home and talk about the teams that you grew up loving, and, you know, especially for me too as a female, there's no females in this market right at that time that did this. And I remember somebody said to me, you know, if you don't take a seat at that table, they're going to give it to another middle-aged straight white guy. You know, like, this is your opportunity to do this. And I thought, what more could I really ask for? To come home, live by my family, live by my friends, be part of this community that I love, cover the teams that I care about. You know, this is why you get into this business, right? So when I laid it out like that, even though I was really sad to leave Bristol, it was kind of a no-brainer.
So what's interesting about that, you, when you were here last, you were producing Bernie.
Mm-hmm.
Now you are getting the opportunity to come home, have a microphone, but now you got to be his co-host. You got to work with him in that regard. And he's got a mental image of you as his producer, which you're going to have to overcome. So take me through how you go from earning his trust as a producer to earning his trust as an on-air sidekick and partner on the show. Because, as you know, like, there is no host and co-host with Bernie. It's, are you talking 30%, 20%, 10%, and on a great day, 40%. But you're never talking 50% because he's got so much stuff to say. So how do you make that work?
I think for me, it was kind of, again, at a good time. I think it all comes back to these things just kind of happen and I adapt to them. But I was a producer for a really long time. So even though it was my first time being a co-host, I still had producer tendencies. So when we would be talking in the segment, I'd be looking at the clock saying, okay, we've got our 5 minutes, but we're off clock. We got a break. So I think I knew when to get in and out, and I would know when to say something to transition into something else because I had those producer tendencies ingrained inside of me. And, you know, Bernie and I, when we first talked about me coming home to do this, we already had that trust factor there. So I think, just like me as a producer, he was like, hey, I know that you've never done this and you're going to have to grow into it and we're going to do it together.
Mm-hmm.
So he, because we had that pre-existing relationship, I don't think it was that difficult of a
transition.
So
what was the hardest part of blending into? Because now you're not behind the scenes. You're in front of the mic. People hear you. You're a face on the radio. So how did you get comfortable in that role? How did you, you know, ultimately feel confident in your own skin being behind a microphone for 3 hours every morning?
So I'm super close with Randy Carricker, who is obviously a legend in this town and an amazing broadcaster. I think more than anyone I've ever worked with, you could throw anybody in a room with Randy Carricker and he can make them sound good.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went out to lunch with him. I sought advice from him and he gave me an unbelievable piece of advice. He said, don't try to be anything other than yourself. He goes, you are from here. People know that. You're not a reporter. You're a fan with access.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, whatever Bernie's going to throw at you numbers wise, you're not going to have that stuff in your arsenal. So what do you need to do? You need to bring a completely different shade to that show that only you can bring as somebody that's from here and who knows what the pulse of the fan base is. And I thought, what a gift he just gave me, because I had all this anxiety about, you know, Bernie's going to come up with all of these brilliant points and how am I going to react to them when I don't know what's coming? And then I thought, I don't have to. I just have to, in that moment, say, wow, that's interesting. Tell me more about it. Or, okay, so you brought up this with, you know, the Cardinals offense. Well, when I, you know, was in the clubhouse, here's what I observed. And I don't have to be him. I just have to be myself. And I think that that really helped.
So you recently moved off the show. You went into digital and social role. You're doing some on-air work still with the station.
Mm-hmm.
But now, having a chance, being removed from the show, looking back, what were the most fun parts of doing the show? What were the toughest parts?
The most fun, and it's the most fun I've ever had in this industry since I started, was this Blue Stanley Cup final run. The Stanley Cup playoffs was, I mean, that's a story that you cannot write. It is a story that if I wasn't here, that I would have been devastated to miss. And I just, for 1 second, did not take for granted the fact that I got to watch these games and come in the morning, and the mic would turn on, and I got to tell St. Louis, here's what happened. Mm-hmm. Let's react together. Can you believe this ride that we're on? And for Randy to tell me, be a fan with Access, what a great time for me to be a fan with Access. You know, I don't have to pretend to be a reporter. I don't have to be anything other than what I am, which is a St. Louisan who is so pumped for what's happening.
What was the hardest part? Let me guess. Waking up?
Nailed it.
I know you're not a morning person.
Not a morning person. But there's a difference between being a morning person and doing a morning show. I'm good to wake up at 6 a.m. I'm good to wake up at 5:30. There is such a difference between waking up at 5:30 and waking up at 4 or waking up at 2:45 or 3. Especially if you're doing a morning show on a music station, you don't have to stay up and watch games. You can go to bed at 8 p.m. You know, I always felt like, how am I going to talk about a game that I didn't see? I can't do that. So I had all this anxiety. I have to stay up and watch the game. I have to, you know, do my notes or whatever. So I was getting maybe 3-4 hours of sleep a night for about a year.
And then you come in and you're irritable, right?
Oh, we all were. It was miserable. Absolutely. Once I transitioned to this new role, the first week that I started, people were like, you seem fresh. You seem different. I go, I get up at 7 a.m. The birds are chirping. I'm, you know, listening to the Bernie show. Life is good when you get rest. It's amazing what it does for you.
You've also done some TV in your career. You mentioned KSDK earlier.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing TV versus radio, what's the hardest part and the best part of doing TV?
For me now, especially looking back, I think it's hard because you only have so much time on TV, especially a local news broadcast. You get, 3 minutes? And you're supposed to pack in all of the stuff that happened in that short of time frame. Now we have 10-minute segments, and we have 12 of them. So especially in today's society, I oftentimes feel like you say something, and if it's not given the proper context, people take it a certain way or whatever. So I think that's really difficult for them. And I look at them, and you know, and I know that they're giving highlights and sound bites, and it's a little, the process is different. But I think if I went back, that would be the biggest challenge, just saying, okay, but how do I tell this story in this short of a time frame?
That was one thing that I found really interesting during my time at ESPN. I remember Michael Irvin used to come on with Dan Patrick every week, and I got a chance to talk to him a few times, and he would always like look forward to being on with DP. And he would always say, look, you know, TV is great because everybody sees me and I get all the accolades from people seeing me on this show, but man, I got to maximize my words. I got to speak in 10 to 20 second sound bites. And everybody thinks that's easy, but telling a story in 20 seconds isn't easy when you're a long-winded guy who tells stories in 5 minutes. And I'm like, that's a very fair point, because it's not that he might not be a great storyteller. He just may not be a great storyteller in 10 to 20 second bites, but that's what they want. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, a conversation can't evolve between five people. And so I was curious about that, because like, you've been in front of a camera. Like, how do you do that effectively? It's hard.
It's really hard. And I think just like anything in this biz, it takes reps. You know, I'm sure if I was to go back to TV now, that would be something I really struggled with. And I would have to every day say, okay, I wrote my script and it's 6 minutes. What do I have to edit out? Like, I had Harrison Bader come in and do my podcast. We did an hour-long podcast, but I control that. It can be an hour long. And it was the first piece of video that I did for the website. He's from New York City, loves fashion. And so I had said to him, what if I show you pictures of your teammates and you judge their fashion looks? And he's like, hilarious, let's do it. So I wanted to show him as many players as I could, because I knew he would be very favorable to a lot of them. And I wanted to make sure I gave him enough so that if he, you know, had something funny, we could work it in. But then I have our video department say to me, hey, this is an 18-minute video. We've got to cut this down. So that was my first test of going back to that TV world and saying, okay, here's the list of players we've had. Red Sharpie. Can you cut this in half? Okay, now we're down to 8 minutes. All right, how do we get it down further? There's a lot of editing that has to be done on the TV side that I think, especially if you come from the audio side of things where you're given that freedom, is really tough.
Since transitioning into digital and social, when you look at sports brands that do social media well, what is it about their execution, their creativity that jumps out and that you think works?
First of all, I see a lot of good videos that are happening. Small, I call them snackable videos. Mm-hmm. I know that's a buzzword, but we live in an ADD society. You wake up, what's the first thing you do? You pull out your phone. What are you doing? You're scrolling your Instagram feed. You're scrolling your Twitter feed. If I see a video that's 30 seconds, a minute long that catches my attention, that's a win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, how do we do that effectively at our station? I also think so many people try to force things on social where it's, okay, this is trending. How do we get involved in that so we can get clicks? And I think that's cheesy and lame. So I think people who aren't trying to jump into the stream, that are kind of creating their own stream, is things that I'm drawn to. I like people who are independently creative. And yeah, just people that aesthetically, whether it's different graphics that you can use on a video or on a stagnant post, how do you catch my attention? And that's what I look at with certain brands.
What are some brands that you follow on, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, that you think do a good job?
Recently, especially since Priscilla went to The Ringer, I've been following The Ringer, and they do a really good job, especially in their, I've noticed, because I'm taking notes on all these brands that do things, but when they put a post out about a story, it'll, you know, here's the link to the story, click on this about the 49ers, the graphic that they use is edited, but it also very much distinctly looks like their brand, whether it's their font or the coloring that they use, but it's an edited photo, but there's cohesion there.
Yep.
And that's really intriguing to me. And I think a lot of brands do that. And that's really smart, because then even if you're absentmindedly scrolling, you can see something and you subconsciously say, oh, that's a Ringer piece of content. Okay, cool. But, you know, that's why I've been reading a lot about Instagram, because that's where everything is trending, you know, different platforms. We're trying to grow our younger audience. So we're going on Instagram. And I've been reading a lot about presets. A lot of people are putting presets on their photos so that aesthetically, when you look at their feed, everything looks the same. It's different content, but it's very aesthetically pleasing. So when I'm scrolling through, the same color tones that I'm seeing are, oh, I know that's Jason Barrett's post. Okay, great. You know, like little things like that that I think we're not supposed to be aware of when we're scrolling and consuming content can make a big difference.
I'm going to hit you with a couple quick hits in a minute to end this thing, but okay. I want to ask you the flip side of that. When you look on social media at sports brands that aren't doing things the right way, or maybe just not maximizing what they could be doing, what are things that you see brands do that they're missing on?
So one of my biggest pet peeves is when brands or people just put a GIF up. That's all you do. It'll be like, oh, you know, we're talking about the Cardinals' horrendous offense, and then it's that Jonah Hill GIF. And you're like, really, the Jonah Hill GIF again? We don't, it's not funny. It's so worn out. But because they've read some article or they've had someone tell them, hey, a photo or especially a GIF with movement is more likely to get a click, they just throw it up there.
Right.
And I think that you see that far too often.
Yep.
And we got to be better. You know, the Jonah Hill GIF could be retired forever as far as I'm concerned.
It's like when I would listen to radio probably like 10 years ago and I would hear all the, you know, the Animal House drops on the radio or the I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take. I'm like, I've heard this for 15 years.
Right.
I'm tired of it. Can we find a new movie? Like, and now today it'd be like, okay, listen, I love Step Brothers. It's one of my favorites. But I don't need to hear every drop on a sports station just because it was cool 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the last movie that was hot that we could find something from? Just continue, you know, to update these things so you stay fresh and relevant with people,
sure.
You know? All right, quick hits. You get to first thought on each of these things, okay?
I'm nervous.
Most important to you, the next Cardinals World Series championship or another Blues championship?
Cardinals.
Biggest heartbreak of your St. Louis sports lifetime has been?
Illinois losing the national championship game.
The person you've learned the most in sports media from is who?
That is so tough. I can't.
You know what I would have told you if you were on the air. You don't sit on a fence. So you pick one.
Well, it's so hard because I've been so lucky that in each step of my career, I've had a mentor that has taught me so much, whether it was Bernie or you, or then I went to the network. It's Sedano. It's Rosillo. It's Liam. You know, now coming back, Tommy Mattern, who is one of our new bosses, he runs The Point. So he's telling me all of these different things about the way that they have built that brand that I have never learned. So, you know, even when I worked with Jen Latta, the way that she taught me to structure a story and all of these things. Like, I remember when I came back, she told me, trust your instincts. You don't know what you're going to remember. And I, at the time, was like, huh? And then I come back and we're talking Cardinals and I'm like, I remember in 2011 when this happened and, you know, she was right.
Right.
So I truly, I'm not trying to sit on the fence.
I'm going to give you a local and national, okay? There's your bailout. You're picking one from the network and one from St. Louis.
Okay, so if we're going network, I'm going to have to say Rosillo. he's one of the most talented people I've ever worked with. And the way that he approaches a show, I have taken so much from him and still apply it to this day. Sarudi and I, who was also a producer on the show, talk about it all the time, about how his mindset and how he approaches building content is awesome. And we still do the things that he taught us to this day. And I would say locally, honestly, I would say for what I'm doing, it's probably Randy Carricker, because we're so similar in the fact that we grew up in St. Louis and we understand what sports means to this community. And we have this interesting role where you're in the media and you have that responsibility and you want to be fair and you want to, you know, portray things a certain way, but you also make no qualms about the fact that you're a fan and that you're from here and that you want these teams to win. And it's not about the laundry. It's the fact that it's St. Louis. It's not the Cardinals. It's not the Blues. It's the St. Louis Cardinals and the St. Louis Blues.
And then the last one, hardest part about working for Jason Barrett is what?
Oh, man. Pressure. Expectations.
I figured you'd get a kick out of that.
But you, more than anyone, shaped my work ethic in this business, because I have worked with a lot of other people who didn't come from the Jason Barrett coaching tree, and they do not have the same aggression and hunger and expectations that are not only set for themselves, but for the station as a whole. And I mean, I tell everybody, this is classic coach speak, you were first one in, last one out. You always had a suit on, and you, I don't know if you had like a Secret Service earbud in, but you never missed a minute of any show. You could have your door closed and I could be like, oh, JB's not in today, or maybe he's in a meeting, and then I'd get a text from you, awesome production return. I'm like, where is this guy? I would have never been able to get to the network or work on these big shows or work with, you know, Sedano and Russillo and Cannell and the Will Canes of the world if I didn't have that foundation in place that you set for us.
I think you benefit from two things. Yes, I'm wired type A, but so is Bernie.
So is Bernie,
and
yes.
So when you're,
and so am I.
Right. So when you got it coming from your PD and you're sitting in front of your host and they both think the same way, you can only help that, like, listen, if I don't do it, they both see it the same way. Like, that's why Bernie and I worked well together, is I don't mind if a guy bitches about something. I mind if he cares about making it great, and he did. So I knew, it was like, all right, well, he's pissed because it's not great. Well, I'm pissed that it's not great. We got that in common. So, okay, producer Michelle, how do we make this great? If you're not interested in making it great, then maybe you shouldn't be doing this. And then you'd be like, okay, I've got to be on their level too. And that, when you love what you do, you feel like you're making a difference, and you feel like the work pays off, and you can step back afterwards going, nobody's on my level. And if you don't feel that and you don't like to compete, I mean, think about a baseball player. You don't go to a game every night going, eh, it's a cool day, I'll just play. No, you watch video, you take batting practice, you're studying the pitcher's habits, and if you don't go 2 for 3 that night, you feel like you screwed up and let the team down. So it's the, you know, in radio, you know, clearly we're not getting paid what ball players do, and it's not as important as what the guy, you know, smashing a 3-run home run in the ninth inning to win a game does. But at the same time, to the people who are listening, it means everything. That is this worth my next 10 minutes of time, or should I go somewhere else? And if you're not good, they're not going to listen to the next 10 minutes. So that's on you. Make the next 10 minutes good.
And I also think that I really benefited, like, as you're breaking this down, I'm thinking, this is why I responded so well to you and Bernie and Russillo, because it's very transparent what your expectations are and what you think my areas of growth are. You were always very blunt about it. And to me, I work well in that environment. How am I supposed to know where I'm supposed to get better if you don't tell me straight up what I'm supposed to do? Listen, a lot of people are intimidated by that. They don't want to work with a Russillo or a Bernie or a Jason Barrett because they don't want to be told certain things you suck at. Like, let's be honest, people in any walk of life, in any job, there's going to be some part of your job that you suck at. And it's just about whether you want to get better at it or not.
Oh, yeah. We were all crappy at one time ourselves. So, like, if someone was telling us we weren't good. Well, now you get to take that and shift that towards digital media and basically get everybody under you to start making sure that they kick ass the same way. Otherwise, I'll be calling you in 6 months going, what's the deal? Are you going to make this great, or are you going to make this average?
I'm going to sick you on that.
It's good seeing you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, BarrettSportsMedia.com.